I'm Nick Zeppos, Chancellor of Vanderbilt University. Welcome to the Zeppos Report, a podcast where I talk with the people shaping and helping us understand our world. My guest today is Amitav Ghosh, a best-selling author whose work puts Asia at the center of global history, culture, and environmental challenges. His books have been translated into more than 20 languages, and his latest work is entitled The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. Amitav received a doctorate from Oxford University, and he has taught throughout India and the United States. He was invited to campus by our Asian Studies Department to lecture in celebration of our program's 50th anniversary. Amitav, welcome to the Zeppos Report.
Thank you, Nick. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
I know that in addition to your talk, you are meeting with various students and faculty members on campus. How do you think the students and the faculty and universities can understand and take steps to educate and talk about and make an impact on climate change?
That's a very good question. To me, it's perfectly clear that climate change is the big issue of our times. You know, I mean, it's the one thing which affects every aspect of our lives, and that'll be more and more the case as we go into the future. I mean, if you look even at the year 2017. To speak of the United States, we had Hurricane Harvey hitting Houston, and Houston, of course, is a big university city. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting for me to speak to my friends in Houston at that time because, you know, the University of Houston was affected, Rice was affected. I mean, it was a real catastrophe.
Yeah, all the medical, in so many ways, MD yes. Anderson, University of Texas Health Center.
Yes. I mean, it's the fourth
just
biggest
devastating.
City. Devastated, yes, absolutely. And at the same time, these wildfires in the West, mm-hmm. you know, burning near the Getty Museum, yeah. Near UCLA. So actually, you know, it's an extraordinary thing. I mean, especially if you think of, let's say, Puerto Rico, you know, amazing that 6 months after the hurricane, what is it? Half the island doesn't have electricity. Yeah. Hospitals are functioning out of tents, and this is, you know, a part of the most powerful and richest nation on earth. You know, yeah. So we can, you know, we can already see that climate change is having an enormous impact on everybody's lives, and this is just the beginning. You know, it's going to accelerate. Young people will have to really deal with these consequences, you know, for which actually our generation is responsible.
Do you find that the students are engaged in the discussion and kind of understand the trade-off decisions or the choices that they're going to have to make individually and collectively?
I think there's a great aversion to thinking about climate change. You know, people don't want to think about it. And in fact, the statistics show that there's less interest in climate change today than 20 yeah. years ago. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, that's interesting to me. What do you kind of ascribe that to? Why do you think, that's a little bit dispiriting to think that there's less interest. Why?
I think it's, you know, this is the thing that really interests me about climate change is that it really upends so many of our ways of thinking, you know. So, you know, for many years now, we've really taught young people that, you know, things will only get bigger, the economy will only get bigger, you will have more and more stuff forever, the world will produce more and more stuff, and they grow up with that idea. So, you know, on the one hand, that's the sort of underpinning of all of their lives, you know, yeah. that they'll always have a bigger cell phone, a bigger car or whatever.
Right.
So this other stuff just doesn't fit mm-hmm. in that framework.
Yeah.
So it just gets ignored.
Where do you see big differences when you go back to different parts of India and the attitudes about climate change and then traveling through Europe and then being in the States? Do you see major differences in attitudes and responses in the different countries that you visit and so often split your time with?
In India and in Europe, there isn't this phenomenon of climate denial. You know, there's nobody who actually questions that climate change is happening or that human beings are responsible for it. But beyond that, are people really taking the sorts of measures that they should take in order to confront, you know, the reality of climate change? The answer is no. And actually, there's a very good book on this subject. It's called Living in Denial. It's by a sociologist who's her name is Carrie Norgaard. She's of Norwegian origin. And she went to Norway and lived in a small town there and did an ethnography of the small town. This town is very rich. It's very highly educated. These people are very well informed. They know about climate change. And climate change is affecting their lives because, you know, it's a resort town, there's skiing and so on, and now there's no snow, so so they're having trouble with that. But it's so interesting. I mean, the people in this town are active on many political issues, but on climate change, they're completely blank.
Yeah. Do you think that there's a certain fatalism, or that's part of the denial, that it's just so big I can't do anything about it, so I might as well enjoy life as it comes at me? I mean, do you think we've made it so catastrophic that the ability of the individual to say I can make a difference, the larger the problem, the more people that could be accountable, the more likely people are going to say there's nothing I can do about it? How do we make it, I guess the catastrophe is make it tangible, but how do we make it tangible for the individual?
I think that's very well put. There is a sense of resignation. There is a sense that, you know, it's actually beyond any individual. But actually, that's not the case. I mean, you know, there are very good organizations. Mm-hmm. There's Bill McKibben's 350.org, which is a very effective organization. So it's not as if there isn't, it's not as if there are no organizations or any effective groups. There are, and people can join them and they can help make a difference. But, you know, going beyond that, the curious thing to me is also that the sorts of decisions that people make. You know, now it's more clear than ever that, say, for example, certain parts of Miami will not be habitable.
Right.
You know, and these are often the most valuable parts of the city, say like Miami Beach and so on. But if you look at the real estate prices, they're just going up.
Yeah, it's interesting to think that we now have so many around the world, but certainly in our country, millions and millions of people living in areas where whenever the waters were this high before, that just wasn't the case. And you really wonder, when does the market start to price in, you know, this may not be habitable in 30 years, 20 years as real estate. Because when you just look at some modeling of cities, even New York City.
Yeah.
You know, the changes will make large parts of areas that people live in now uninhabitable. And that's very expensive areas, because a lot of these are expensive, though, real estate near water.
And not just near water. I mean, the disaster that happened in Houston because of Hurricane Harvey is that people were living in areas that were really swampland, or, you know, where there should be water
bodies.
Or
you talk about the ski areas as kind of like, okay, well, if you develop large tracks for tourism and all of a sudden there's not enough snow, you know, it's you're right. It's not just near the water. In The Great Derangement, you point out that serious literature seems to be incapable of grappling with catastrophes like climate change. What would a kind of a climate change novel, or how does narrative and storytelling the role of literature in representing climate change. Obviously, in many areas of literature, we've talked about nature, we've represented nature, we've represented catastrophes. What does such a body of work look like to you?
Well, you know, as you say, in the past, people did, writers have written very powerfully about nature. I mean, I think of Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath as a book about climate change, in a sense.
Yeah.
Similarly, you know, if you think of Melville's Moby Dick, it's a book that's so much about nature and the world around us. But actually, what's happened over the last 20 or 30 years, it's one of the great ironies that even as climate change is becoming more evident, and even as the impacts are being felt more and more, people write less and less in that vein. I mean, it's almost impossible to think of anyone writing a book like Moby Dick today.
Yeah.
And
or even the kind of romantic literature, or the just the kind of capturing of a back to nature, the beauty of nature, a kind of literary pantheism that, you know, has representation in many different cultures.
Absolutely. But that's gone now. Yeah. I mean, in as much as pantheism exists, it's about gadgets.
Right, right. No, no.
Gadgets are your gods.
Yeah, yeah. How does industrialization and climate change alter the perspective of Indian history and East Asian history over time? And, you know, we think of it very much in this country as a mature economy that is, you know, coming to grips with this, but yet other countries are industrializing at different paces and changing the face of nature and landscape and city. How does that change or make us rethink Asian history?
I think it makes us, it forces us to really reconsider the place of Asia in the world. Because, you know, Asia came late to industrialization in a sense, not Japan, but the rest of Asia. But Asia, the sheer numbers of Asia are such that a small change in Asia becomes a big change for the world. So, for example, you know, the climate change impacts were already being noticed from the 50s onwards. But it was really when Asia began to industrialize that the rate of emissions of greenhouse gases really shot up. So even now, even though the individual Indian or the individual Chinese has a very small carbon footprint, simply because India is so populous and so is China, that has had a huge impact, you might say. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, one of the things which is, I suppose we don't really confront enough is that this issue is no longer in the hands of the West.
Right.
It's really in Asia.
Right. Yeah, and then how do you, you know, kind of historically, when you think of industrialization of India and then the industrialization of China, yet the geopolitical competition between India and China, do you see signs of regional cooperation between China and India on global climate change?
Well, it's a complicated story. China and India have certainly cooperated in the big IPCC meetings on certain issues. China is a country which is actually adapting very, very fast.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why they're adapting is precisely because, you know, they see commercial opportunities. Yeah. So, for example, in alternative energy, they're by far the world leader. And India also has been developing alternative energy, but not at the same rate. China also has other kinds of adaptation measures, you know, like coastal retreats, for example, which are very well organized. You know, it's actually kind of interesting to see how in the U.S., neither Florida nor southern Texas could organize an evacuation, you know, before the before these hurricanes, mm-hmm. whereas China regularly moves, you know, enormous numbers of people out of the way, mm-hmm. you know, when hurricanes hit the southern coast and so on.
Yeah.
So in those ways, you know, China is actually in many ways developing a certain kind of climate resilience. And there are certain, and there are climate scientists, for example, Naomi Oreskes, whose name you probably know, mm-hmm. who's a very eminent historian and climate scientist. In one of her books, she writes, she suggests that, in fact, one of the few countries that are, that's actually going to survive climate change is China. So, you know, it's a very strange, it's a very curious story. I don't know how exactly it's going to play out. But one thing I think we can be sure of is that Asian countries are not going to scale back on industrialization until the West starts to do it as well.
Right, that's kind of one of the interesting arguments, whether it's on global climate change or intellectual property protection, yeah. which is when you have countries that are moving to the front and other countries that, you know, maybe were the inventors who want to protect intellectual property or want to keep industrializing, and then in India or China says, well, we should have the right to do that, and you have that right, and you've got to accept some of the trade-offs. But, you know, obviously that sort of discussion, particularly in our country, has not been well received. I mean, it's, and maybe it's a function of human nature or the nation state to say, your economic productivity is going to go down, so these people across the world is going to go up. It's just finding that common humanity. Is it through literature or international accords or all of the above?
You know, I think we are often sort of inclined to think that human beings are a cooperative species and so on, but in fact, human beings have always lived in conflict. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly how climate change is playing out. It's playing out as a kind of equivalent of war, yeah. really. That's
well,
what
it is. Yeah, and when you... you made the comment before, which I think is fascinating, which is if you look at China and India and their large populations and then where they are on a development industrialization curve, they actually have a very small per capita carbon footprint. But is one of the concerns or the concern those countries have, Amitabh, that, well, we are going to have larger carbon footprints because we are going to increase the standard of living for many people who are without the basic necessities. And you've got to let us lift people up to a standard that you already have, and that's going to increase our carbon footprint.
That's exactly the argument, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, what we now call development or wealth is really nothing other than carbon.
Yeah.
It's the same thing, you know. It's just based on emissions. It's just based on energy use. So what we call a better life today is really just all about energy. It's all about carbon.
Yeah. Although, like you said, you could see a country like China, and it may be just because of their ability to control things, kind of saying, "Okay, we're going to own cars. We're going to drive up the quality of life in a consumer way. We're going to have larger cities, but we're going to leapfrog the technology and rely more on alternative energies."
That's certainly what they're doing. And I think China will end up with a mix, you know, of energy sources, which is quite different from that of the U.S. But, you know, In the first place, one thing we should not forget is that, solar energy, wind energy, it also requires us, the use of a lot of materials and a lot of, in order to build a windmill, you need a lot of steel, you need a lot of cement. Mm-hmm. Cement is the second most polluting thing on the planet after after fossil fuels. So it's not as if those things don't have any kind of environmental impact. And into the foreseeable future, really, it's hard to see that fossil fuel use is going to disappear. So that's really the kind of, as you say, the dispiriting part, because actually what we need is a scaling back of our lives. Mm. And that's what I don't see happening, really. I mean, Jimmy Carter, did try to tell people.
On.
Yeah, he said, we have to live with tightening our belts. And what happened? I mean, he got voted out.
Yeah.
So today in the world, it's very hard to see any politician who's actually going to go up before their electorate and say, okay, now we're going to lead smaller lives.
Or have a carbon tax.
Yeah, well, that's actually what we need.
Yeah. Well, you see this from multiple perspectives, and you spend time in Calcutta. You said your mother is still there.
Yes, yes.
And then you have a home in Goa. And then, of course, you're in Brooklyn, which has flooding problems when things happen. How do you see each of those cities and areas talking about and dealing with climate change, but also the resources that are given to us?
It's interesting that you ask that, actually, because my mother's home in Calcutta is it's where I grew up, but I recently discovered that it's in a very flood-prone area, and Calcutta, a large part of Calcutta is actually below sea level.
Yeah, right.
So if there is a major storm, it'll be catastrophic for Calcutta. So I tried to talk to her about it, and I said, just in terms of safety and in terms of caution, perhaps you should move somewhere else. And she looked at me as if I was mad and said, how can I leave my house and go and live somewhere else?
Yeah.
I mean, she's in her 80s. And really, that's the issue that we all face. It's inertia. I mean, who's going to give up their house and move somewhere, We are all attached to, we have our attachments, we have our places, and,
What, when you look at the research you've done and the connections between the environmental crises in the Indian Ocean and historical conflicts, what are the lessons, what are the experiences we see, and what are the lessons you can take away from, as you mentioned, conflict occurring when resource and pollution come into play?
Well, the Indian Ocean has historically been the most important commercial waterway of the world. The Atlantic overtook it for maybe a century or a century and a half. But simply because the Indian Ocean is, the coasts of the Indian Ocean are so heavily populated, the Indian Ocean is inevitably a very, it's a very important sort of waterway. Well, there are so many sorts of impacts that are happening in the Indian Ocean right now. For example, fisheries are collapsing. There are these huge dead zones, which are anoxic zones.
Yeah.
Those have happened because of, fertilizer flowing into the sea.
Right.
Then it creates a sort of all these blooms and, all the oxygen is depleted in the water. Fish can't live there. But if you just take one small part of the Indian Ocean, the part that I'm from, the Bay of Bengal, one quarter of humanity lives on the shores of the Bay of Bengal.
Wow, that's incredible.
The Bay of Bengal directly supports something at least around 200 million people, you know, with its fisheries, its waterways, etc. Now the fisheries of the Bay of Bengal are really collapsing. And we see already the fallouts of these things because, you know, now fishermen, it often happens in the Indian papers, you'll read Indian fishermen have been captured by the police in Pakistan, Coast Guard in Pakistan.
Yeah.
Now they've even been captured in Iran. You know, they wander into the territorial waters of Iran and are captured there. And these are fishermen from the East Coast. So they're having to venture further and further afield, you know. So it creates these situations of conflict. One of the most obvious sort of situations of fields of conflict in the Indian Ocean is exactly this this Somali area. You know, Japanese, Chinese, European trawlers have overfished those waters to the point where the Somalis literally lost all their sources of protein and nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from that, you know, certain European countries were dumping the radioactive waste, you know, off the coast of Africa. So these Somalis were literally driven to take to piracy. You know, and as we know, Somali piracy has profoundly disrupted shipping in that area. And it's also resulted, you know, in a kind of what you might call deterritorialization, which we already see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, America is no longer just within its borders.
Right.
You know, it now has a border in Abu Dhabi.
Right.
I don't know if you ever come through Abu Dhabi airport, but you can actually go through customs and immigration in Abu Dhabi. You know, and this is a pattern that...
Oh, yeah, I have.
Yeah. So, you know, just think about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's you're actually externing your border into very distant places.
Yeah.
And this is a model that's happening more and more around the world. Now we have armed merchant ships, you know, so we're going back to like an 18th and 17th century model in that sense.
Yeah.
So...
it's interesting how retro... The model, I mean, maybe we just go back to the old models of arming, having either escorts or arming the ships in a way that, you know, I think is surprising to a lot of people. I also think that you make a great point in the feedback mechanism of, okay, if there's not enough fish that supports our society, we are going to have malnutrition, or we're going to find substitute goods that might not be healthy, or we will raid other parts to get the food that we need. And so the ramifications of the overfishing is just rippling through the geography and the environment, whether it's on land, on the water, or on land.
You know, just on the question of fishing, what we have done to the oceans is truly beyond shocking. You think of one of these trawlers. They have nets 12 miles long, 12 kilometers long, you know. These are nets of fairly small mesh.
Right.
So they go through the water. It's not just that they're catching some fish.
Right.
They're scooping up entire ecosystems. You know, and all in order for to catch a few fish that they can sell. But the rest of the ecosystem is just thrown out.
Right.
It's just treated as waste.
Right.
You know, how can the ocean survive? You know, and there are hundreds of these trawlers.
Yeah.
Every day they're scooping up just giant chunks of the waters. So obviously these ramifications will be felt elsewhere. And they are being felt, for example, in Europe. I mean, as the Sahel in Africa dries up,
right,
more and more people are now trying to throw themselves across the borders. You know?
Right. That's the other thing, which is making clear the linkage between environmental disaster, climate change, and the movement of people to escape. What are the consequences of the environmental degradation? And clearly the movement of refugees and the movement of people, even in armed ways, is going to reflect we need to move because it's horrible here and we'll do anything to get out, or on the other side, we need to move. We have a big army, and so we're going to move into your territory and take your land for grazing or your water for fishing.
That's already happening in many parts of the world. But I think we see the effects most clearly in Europe, you know. Very large. Last year I spent a lot of time visiting refugee centers and in Italy, especially in Sicily, which is actually facing the bulk of the. And it was very, very interesting, you know, because you can see that a very large number of the migrants are actually from climate affected areas,
right?
Somaliland, and also from the Sahel, Sudan,
the Sahel,
et cetera,
right?
Mali, but. So, you know, there's that in the first place. And already we can see the politics of Europe have been completely upended. Completely upended. I mean, the Brexit, Europe. But the most interesting thing, I think, is that, you know, this is irreversible. Mm-hmm. This flow is irreversible. It can't be stopped.
Right.
It literally can't be stopped unless, you know, nations completely abandon all their all law,
right?
You know, and I think one of the things we never speak about, but which is actually very, very important in this migration, is that this migration is also driven by technology. Yeah. All these movements are actually made possible by cell phones.
Right.
I mean, you'll have seen, you know, the migrations of the past. I mean, you know, if you look at the iconography of, say, the migrations to Ellis Island, it's, you know, the migrant is with a bundle standing on a ship. You'll see today the picture of the migrant is always with the cell phone because the cell phone makes it all possible. The exchanges of money, the transfers of money, the links, the connections that are
made. Where to go, where the connections made, and how to find a safe place once you
all of that
once you get there. Technology really enables
it's completely technology driven. This is what people don't understand. This is an effect of social media. You know, it's not just that it enables the migration, it also creates the fervor for migration, because you know, suppose you're a rice farmer in rice farming is very, very hard work.
Right.
You know, and you're looking at your cell phone and seeing pictures of your friend sitting in a cafe in Berlin.
Right.
I mean, what are you going to do?
Well,
so I was really struck by the number
That's profound too. Yeah. And but now that you mention it, it's pervasive when you look at the movement of people and the use of technology.
You know, it's completely driven by technology. One doesn't realize this. I don't know why people talk about all the other impacts. But in fact, the migration and the climate impacts are not, one is not an effect of the other. They are the same thing.
Right, right.
You know?
So do you want to share anything about your next book project? I'm sure you have multiple projects going on, but talk to us a little bit about your next book project.
Well, I'm writing a novel, which is what I normally do.
Yeah. Great novels.
Thank you.
Yeah, and what do you can you give us a little glimpse into what it's about?
Well, I hope you won't mind, but I have a superstition about unfinished work.
Good for you. Good for you. Well, Amitav, thank you for joining me to discuss the importance of addressing our current environmental crisis and the impact of history on climate change. It's an honor to have you here at Vanderbilt. You can download this and other episodes of the Zeppos Report at vu.edu/Zeppos-report. Amitav, have a great visit. It's a privilege to have you visiting with us today.
It's been a great pleasure. It's an honor for me. And thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you.